The Mincing Rascals are back. This is John Williams, and here we go, one day later than usual, to accommodate my vacation with many rascal listeners. This time we mince on the president's motives for commuting Rod Blagojevich's sentence. How is the violence here every weekend different than what happened in El Paso and Dayton? And would you want a pot store in your town? There are a couple of new voices on the pod this week. You know, we always appreciate your feedback. I'm John Williams at WGNRadio.com. You want to comment or advertise here? That's how to reach us. Today is Friday, August 9th, 2019. It's 11:23 now in the morning. Hi, I'm John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals. This is a weekly podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio. Listen for me weekdays from 1 to 3.
And I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune. I write the Spin Politics newsletter.
I'm Justin Kaufman. I am the host of Extension 720 and the daily podcast Lower Wacker Live.
I'm Eric Cohn. I'm the marketing manager at the Illinois Policy Institute.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the columnist for the... I'm Steve Bertrand, host of the Business Lunch on WGN Radio.
Eric Zorn is not with us today. It's nice to have two new voices in the mix on the Mincing Rascals. Welcome to you both. Thanks for joining us today. Oh, by the way, I wasn't here last week because I was on vacation.
Yes.
And with 150 WGN listeners, we were in Paris, and then we went up the Seine to Normandy on the year of the 75th anniversary of D-Day. And I have so many thoughts about that. I'm not going to take time here. I'll talk about it more on the radio side. But I did just want to share, anytime I get an opportunity, the following. And that is, particularly in Normandy, it was so nice to see American flags flying in lawns, statues to Eisenhower or other Americans in town squares, and the sort of appreciation that the French, at least in that part of France, and I would say elsewhere, have for what America did in World War II is remarkably fresh.
You know, the United States is one of the few countries where people fly their flag at home.
I don't know what you just said.
So if you go to Germany or France or Great Britain, people don't put their country flag on their house. No, it's kind of an American thing.
You know what else is just American? Baseball.
Thank you for that kind of non sequitur.
Yeah.
But back to my point, I just thought it was really so. We went to a ceremony there at Omaha Beach, and then they play the taps, and we all sing the national anthem. And the woman comes out from France, sort of the docent for this little mini ceremony, and she said, I want to thank you for my freedom and the freedom that my family enjoys today. She's saying this to Americans she doesn't know. And we didn't really anticipate that. And it just kind of gave you goosebumps. It also felt good because Americans don't even like Americans right now. And here was somebody from another country coming out and just saying, thank you, we love you, and 75 years later, we still appreciate what you did. And that was, when you ask 150 people I traveled with for 10 days, what was a highlight, almost all of them would say that moment on the trip. So that was very, very nice. Back to reality now. Returning from his remarks in Texas and Ohio, Toledo for short, the president almost assured that he'll commute the sentence of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. But then, so as to keep the viewers watching, like the good game show producer that he is, he tweeted a more tepid view of the topic. He said last night that, quote, staff is continuing the review of this matter. That tweet got some of the details right that he had previously gotten wrong, and it makes me wonder if someone else besides Patty Blagojevich has since gotten in his ear.
I'm no fan of Rod Blagojevich's at all, and I'm happy he's in prison. But I think the sentence probably was excessive, so maybe it's time for him to be released. But I think what Trump is doing to his family, to the Blagojevich family, is terrible.
I thought he was treated unbelievably unfairly. He was given close to 18 years in prison, and a lot of people thought it was unfair, like a lot of other things. And it was the same gang, the Comey gang, and all these sleazebags that did it. And his name is Rod Blagojevich, and I am thinking about commuting his sentence.
I think he just speaks and then follows up later, and I don't know that Blagojevich is any closer to being released today than he was a week ago.
I thought all along that Rod went to jail too long, but now I want him to stay in jail because Donald Trump is just using his release as a distraction, or he's trying to score some sort
of
political
points.
I can't
think of his daughters and his wife. I mean, you know.
Who did more ill to the Blagojevich kids? Donald Trump now or Patty Blagojevich then?
I'm with you there, but you know, to hear that I'm strongly considering it, and he was put away by Comey, which of course Comey wasn't even in the FBI.
He was in
at
private
time.
Practice that whole time.
Issue with the story is that I agree with Steve that you know you can make a strong argument that sentence was too long, but what the president did in his tweet was or on Air Force One was talk about how. He was unfairly treated, or that he made a couple calls. He's sort of going back and he's putting cracks in the foundation of why he went to jail in the first place. You can argue the sentence, but I don't think you can argue the fact that he tried to sell the U.S. Senate seat, and that should not be at all diminished, and it seems like that's what the president's doing.
The first thing that always comes to mind is selling the Senate seat. People forget things like he tried to shake down a children's hospital for a campaign contribution.
The pediatric doctors, the reimbursement, is that going out yet or is that still on hold?
The rate increase?
Yeah.
It's January 1.
And we have total discretion over it?
Yep.
We could pull it back if we needed to, budgetary concerns, right?
We sure could. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Which, if selling the Senate seat is gross, that's truly grotesque. But what sticks out to me is exactly what you talked about. You have Patty Blagojevich lobbying in to get her commutation for her husband. It makes to me think that people will be more cynical about our system of justice. That if you have prestige, fame, you've been on a television show with the President of the United States, one thing can happen to you. People put away for drug crimes that they probably shouldn't be put away for continue to languish in prison. And it gives people this view that there's two types of justice in America, and that's not healthy.
I think we're going into this 2020 election. He's kind of at the precipice of something here. Either he's going to zoom or he's going to sink. And I think he is trying to make the case that, hey, this Justice Department, no matter who's in charge of it, is terrible. Look what they tried to do to me. Look what they did to my friend Rod, who was on my you know show. And I think you have that. I also think that you have somebody who is trying to distract. It's just what you said. Things did not go well on these trips to Ohio and Texas. He did not get the media coverage he had hoped for because the hospitals did not want the cameras in there, and in part because he has a PR team that does not seem to know how to help him, you know, push his message. These can be good stories. I find it myself. I call the White House, hey, or I email them, and I hear nothing back. And these are opportunities to have your voice heard here in the middle of the country. He's got backers here. I hear from them. I think it's a distraction. And I also think that he is trying to sort of really ram home this idea that the Justice Department, they're fraudulent.
I think it's important, too. I want to stress again that he makes things up. You know, he blamed Blagojevich's conviction and prosecution on James Comey.
And that's, on a single call.
And that's not a small thing. James Comey was not the Robert Mueller. He could have picked Mueller. He hates him, too. Was the director of the FBI during the investigation and during the prosecution. But the president just makes things up. And I'm afraid that his followers believe what he says.
It also goes against the whole concept of drain the swamp. You know, as Donald Trump comes in, the whole concept was these guys are taking advantage of their offices. They want it for personal or political gain. They don't care about the American people. That is Rob Blagojevich is the poster child for that.
Yeah.
So for him to go in and say, oh, no, he was treated unfairly, not him. The other guys.
And he went after Hillary Clinton, right, in 2016 for that. This whole Clinton Foundation state.
Went after George Ryan. When Blago campaigned, he said, we're going to get corruption out of office. Get rid of those guys. I'm going to be the man of the people. Props to Patty, at least, right? I mean, none of this matters to Patty Blagojevich. She wants to get her husband home to be with their daughters. And she's been playing masterfully this whole damn thing.
She knows her way around the swamp.
She just says, well, exactly. If I can get on Fox TV and make that message.
This is so dangerous because it allows the FBI and power-hungry, overzealous prosecutors like Patrick Fitzgerald to go after anyone that they don't like.
You got to admit that's been working.
That's the alarming thing, that the way to get policy or any kind of changes to happen is to get on Fox and Friends and get in the president's ear. Mm-hmm. There's something, I think, alarming to me about all of that. But it is bizarre to me to continually be revisiting the Blagojevich spectacle that we had, which I don't know if anybody listened to Public Official A, the podcast that Dave McKinney did. Going back, there are even things that I'd forgotten about, that, you know, what kicked off the whole investigation was basically Dick Mell mouthing off because Rod Blagojevich wouldn't hire the people he wanted him to hire and give business to the people he wanted him to give business to.
It's still my favorite quote of all time when they put it on the splash on the front of the Sun-Times and said, "You drove a stake through my heart." That's what Dick Mell said about Rod Blagojevich when we're talking about the garbage dump in Rod. But what a great Chicago politics
quote. Go back and listen to some of the archived audio, the scheming voice that Blago has, and all of the people that are playing into his scheme. I mean, J.B. Pritzker is probably wishing this story didn't happen right now because he makes some cameos, too.
I actually am calling you about, I think you appoint his replacement, don't you?
Ooh, interesting. Let's think about that. You interested in that?
That's the one I would want.
Now, here's how about this scenario.
Makes a lot of sense.
Listen, you're extremely open-minded on that. But don't rule yourself out completely on that Senate thing.
And he was at the fair yesterday, the kickoff of the fair, and was saying, you know, he needs to, you know, Rod Blagojevich needs to serve out his term. My friend, who Rauner had used all the video, or I'm sorry, the audio tapes of Pritzker, then candidate Pritzker, or even before he was a candidate, citizen Pritzker, talking to Blagojevich about a possible
treasury,
a treasurer, maybe attorney general, state attorney general, all these different
gigs.
I love
that. So Blago says, "Hey,
there's an AG I can appoint. JB, are you a lawyer?
Yeah.
There's an AG that I appoint."
Oh, that's it.
You see what I'm saying?
Don't rule that out. I won't rule that out. I mean, which is, I think, to the point that the president was trying to make. That was just braggadocio or whatever, however you pronounce it. It was just him scheming and thinking, is that a crime? Should he go to jail for that? That's the way Trump is sort of pitching the thing, too, that it was just bragging phone calls.
Trump hasn't had a thought below the surface about this. He couldn't tell you, you know, who convicted him or what he was convicted for. And, you know, and another thing, if I can segue a little bit, because of this idea, this Trump plan of just making things up that too many people in this country are willing to believe because they say it. Ivanka Trump did it this week as well in Chicago. And, John, I don't know if you're aware, there was a very violent weekend in Chicago. There were 52 people shot,
seven.
And she tweeted out, "Let's not forget the violence in the inner cities where seven people were killed, 52 injured near a playground in Chicago."
She had the numbers wrong, too.
She had the numbers wrong. She had the spot wrong. But she did it. She implied that it was a single shooting.
We're not paying attention as the media to this.
Right. And you know, and that's what the conspiracy theorists who follow them read that and think, my God.
I got it. The best part about that story was Lori Lightfoot, the mayor of Chicago, who came out and I believe just eviscerated. I mean, this is where I love Mayor Lightfoot, in the way that she doesn't mince words. She came after Ivanka in that moment. It's like, you got it wrong.
She got the numbers wrong. She got the location wrong. That's the danger of trying to govern via tweet. That's the danger of somebody with a platform and audience that time that doesn't know what they're talking about, that they could easily figure out if they wanted to be a constructive and engaged partner.
You said it was a playground. It wasn't a playground. It was Douglas Park.
And not only was it Douglas Park, it was all over the city.
Yeah.
I mean, those were the city totals. But she tweeted as if it was one attack.
She made it seem, she, you know, just kind of put a tweet out, made it seem like it was 52 people.
I know Lisa has a point, but I just have to say, Lisa, that she also used the word mustn't, which I don't think we should ever do in a tweet.
Mustn't.
Lightfoot has been taking off on President Trump, and it almost looked like Ivanka was coming in here, tweeting this thing out, kind of making Lori Lightfoot, you know, look like she doesn't know how to control crime. So don't go after my dad about gun control.
Yeah.
There was sort of a little bit of a side slap there to kind of put her, seemingly to put her in her place.
I'm going to guess that that's something that Mayor Lightfoot is not unhappy she said out loud.
Oh, no.
color me shocked that Ivanka Trump has a thumbless grasp of the crime and gun violence problem in Chicago.
Okay, but
I don't think that's surprising.
But when I was in France, we're all trying to escape the world, right? And we're looking at headlines on our phones and then turning them off. And one of the headlines I saw was, should we consider the weekend violence that we regularly allow, you know, that we sort of accept, that's the reality of Chicago. Should it be in the same box as what happened in Texas or Ohio?
We talked about this a little bit last night on Extension 720, but this concept that there is a difference. And it's almost, and I hate to put it this way because it comes across crass, but this idea, it's a gang war in Chicago that is causing most of the violence on the streets. So usually it's targeted. There's going, now don't get me wrong, there are going to be times when people are caught in a crossfire, yeah. And we see that. And Chicago and the nation reacts accordingly when it's an innocent victim who's underage, maybe, you know, when I think it was a 12-year-old that was in the alley, and then the little baby that was shot in the crossfire. That's the sort of byproduct of war. What's happening on the streets of Chicago is a war. It's a fallout war. Terrorism is what's happening when it comes to mass shooting, where someone goes into a place of business or other places to kill innocent people. There's a difference between the two. I'm not saying that the one is more violent than the other, but I would it's almost like the same idea as that if you look at a war, like say in Afghanistan, if there is a mass suicide bombing and it kills 75 people, that's different than if soldiers...
The day-to-day violence. Or
if soldiers were killed in a battle.
I think that's a really important point, because you have, because of the commonality of the device that is used to commit the violent act, we're talking about these things as if they are the same. They're not the same. They're in different buckets. They need to be dealt with in different ways. And it's the kind of whataboutism that you get of when these mass shootings happen, horrible, awful, that you get this, well, what about the violence in Chicago? Okay, we can have both of those conversations, but we're talking about fundamentally different
things. But they're not the same conversation.
I guess, but
they're still young people that are being killed, and I don't know how to characterize these combatants in the war you're talking about, Justin.
You have the national headline of mass shooting, you know, 20 people killed and 50 injured, and then you have a weekend where it's 7 people killed in Chicago. It is always, you have to think about sort of the refrain of that. Sort of, we have these big national stories because of these big national horrible events. And then the afterthought is, what about Chicago? And there's a socioeconomic thing, a race thing here. And you can't deny that, because we should have the same reaction. I mean,
or empathy or sympathy, but we don't. Those are such marginalized people.
Not empathy, not sympathy, just sympathy. It's got to be action.
But go ahead, start there.
Yeah.
I think Justin's about to speak for me. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, buddy. I would never speak for Steve.
No, but they are different, and so I think our reactions would be different. I mean, there's, you know, look, my daughter went to the University of Dayton, and her favorite bar was mentioned by this guy as a possible target one time. So there's a difference in, well, it's hard to use the right words, because I don't want to imply that the victims in Chicago aren't innocent, but it's...
Justin's point.
Some of the victims are innocent.
Some of the victims are innocent, and that's the crossfire, and I think that there's an appropriate amount of indignation when that happens. But when you're talking about two rival cliques in Inglewood, and one of the kids rolls up on a bike and he shoots up a porch...
I understand.
It's terrible.
That.
It's okay. Victim, everything in there. But right, that's different than a guy putting on body armor and saying, I want immigrants, I'm going to walk into
it
Walmart.
Is, but
They're
I want to have that other conversation for just a second, which is that if that kid's 15 or 16, I think, how did that kid get there? Yeah. And we all just say, he's a bad kid.
Absolutely.
That's exactly what Eric was saying. That's a conversation.
We need to have that conversation,
but it's not the same one as mass killings.
It's also, I think, understanding history is important to understanding the present, that the kind of the gang war that you're talking about is the result of the Chicago Police Department being successful in taking down the major gangs that existed 20, 30 years ago. The theory was like, it was like the mafia. If you cut the head off of it, it's all going to kind of disperse. But that's not what happened. I remember listening to the Harper High School episodes of This American Life from several years ago, where they talked about, you know, the constant refrain when you hear about, you know, people in gangs in Chicago is like, well, just don't join a gang. You're born into one based on the block that you live.
You don't have a choice.
You can't get out of that.
You just live there, and they automatically, you're guilty by association to someone who lives on a different block.
Doesn't Alex Kalowitz write about that in his latest book a lot?
Eric makes a good point. Linda and Ben and the guys and Iroh did the Harper High School. That was a defining moment to recognize, because that's not, the police doesn't tell you that. They don't tell you that every block is considered a gang in some of these neighborhoods, and you're not necessarily a gang banger. You just live. They changed the wording. It's now clique. It's not gang. And that the problem is that you have to figure out how you deal with that on a I don't know, block by block basis. I don't even know how you deal with that. Block is a gang.
Well, you don't.
Without the large organizations, there's also no accountability structure there. Like, 3-year-olds getting shot would not have been something, as horrible as we should say that gangs were 20, 30 years ago. That's not something the leadership of those groups would have tolerated, but now there's no enforcement mechanism, and now you get this kind of chaos that you have.
Look, the world was a safer place during the Cold War. when the Soviet Union and the United States offset each other and kept all the surrogates in line. I mean, it's the same situation on a global level.
You know, the book I'm also thinking of is Sudhir Venkatesh's Gang Leader for a Day, where he said there was structure, there was organization. And Sudhir, this academic from the University of Chicago, actually then kind of fell in with the gang journalistically and became a gang leader for a day. It's the title of his book. And he writes about the structure and how organized it was and how there was discipline. I'm not arguing for that, but it just seems to be more mayhem
to
right
me,
now.
To me, it is. And I want to make it clear, because I don't want to come across callous and that some lives are more important than others, because that's bogus. There's a systemic reason why we're here in Chicago, and that conversation has to be had, and action needs to come from it. Mm-hmm. Meaning there needs to be a look at how poverty plays into this, and how our institutions are playing
education.
A role, education plays a role.
The all general that is a, failure is, of our state.
There yeah. is there is a conversation to be had and action to be had that is different than what happened in El Paso. And
so do
I mean, no truer thing has been said, you know, on the campaign trail, then you can't arrest this issue. You can't arrest the problem. This can't come from police. It's got to come from City Hall. It's got to come from the business community.
So then what do you think of Mitch McConnell's hesitancy to call the Senate back earlier than September? And he says, I don't want to do it because it'll just devolve into more bickering. I don't know how we're ever going to get around the bickering, to be honest with you.
Mitch McConnell, the guy who represented his political enemies with tombstones on the day after the attack, is that the guy we're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, frankly, I don't know that it matters much if they do it next week or if they do it when they come back. I mean, if the president's to be taken at his word, he's talking with congressional leaders from both sides about coming up with some sort of legislation.
Well, there is that House bill. I mean, let's vote on that. And to me, that's no panacea. But
well, what does it mean that the NRA came out and said, be careful, President, because your base does not agree with background checks? Right. What does that mean?
It means the president's no longer considering commuting Blagojevich's sentence.
And he also went on vacation for 10 days this morning, so nothing's going to get... I mean,
who went on vacation for 10 days?
President. This is August vacation.
To be fair, there is a long precedent now of not a whole lot happening in Congress, which I think is one of the bigger systemic problems that we have as a nation, that we do not have a legislature anymore. We have a body of people who are more interested in being pundits on television. To me, the most informative member of Congress we've had recently was Jason Chaffetz from Utah, who resigned to become a talking head on cable news. So whether or not he calls the Senate back, nothing's going to happen, because there is no consensus on what to do.
So when it comes to the guns, it's very, very interesting. I had a guy not last week from the Illinois State Rifle Association talking about this before the mass shootings, but that there has been a movement, these red flag laws, and that the states would take over regulating guns because the federal government can't, because it's just too massive. But what's happening is that lawsuits are coming against those states saying, and this is a federal issue, and trying to bounce it back to the federal saying, well, the federal has jurisdiction and they don't do anything, so nothing will be regulated. That's where we're at right now, where it's like, it used to be that there was a fight to say, hey, the states should be able to take care of their business. Now it seems like gun rights advocates are trying to say that the federal government is in charge of that. I don't know. I feel like we're in some crazy loophole that is like one of like the new roller coaster of Great America. It just does not.
It's kind of a circular thing.
Yeah. So it's going to be based on cultural ideals then? Sort of each state, each.
That's the idea,
you know?
Right?
Is that a bad thing?
Because then you get Indiana doing gun laws one way and Illinois doing another, and then people just cross the border.
But I think there's an important point to make there, too, which is that one of the things that is not prosecuted is straw purchases. It's very low on the priority list of prosecutors, and it is something for pointing out correctly that guns are purchased in Indiana. They're brought into Chicago because they're harder to acquire here. They don't prosecute the people who are making those purchases. That can be an inhibition to those kinds of things happening. There's a lot of priorities that need to change in this conversation.
So I want to go to the Dayton shooter again, and everyone's saying, there were these warning signs. The authorities should have seen. He was kicked out of school. He did all these terrible things. It's like, okay, we see that. So what is it that we are expecting our government or our police agencies to do with that? We don't preemptively lock people up in this country, right? We don't do that. And that seems to be what the advocates are saying. Well, you should have known. Well, then so what?
We don't even preemptively keep them from buying a gun, which was something that the president had signed, Obama had, and that the Trump administration struck. What if somebody was demonstrating something that clearly was a red flag? should the law allow the federal government or a state government to take your weapons away or to keep you from purchasing it? It's a very slippery slope.
So this is a proposal that I actually think makes a lot of sense, is this idea of gun violence restraining orders, so that states could pass legislation to empower people. When you see these red flags coming up, and I think we could agree, especially with the Ohio shooter, they clearly were there. The man had a kill list and a rape list. When he came back to school, there was a bunch of students who weren't there because they were afraid of him. To be able to go to a court and make an argument and say, we believe this person to be a danger to himself or to others, and for a limited period of time, they can take weapons away from that person and also provide them the due process that they should be provided in our system to argue that, no, this is incorrect, they shouldn't be taken away from me.
The only problem is that there needs to be resources allocated to that. There are not, right now, there's not law enforcement that can do that. There's not a court that can do that. So you'd have to set up all these systems to do that, which I agree. I think that's an excellent idea.
But we're not even allowed to know how many guns they have. So, right? There's no gun registry. There's no gun registration or list. So say you find someone with red flags, you're going to go take his guns away, and he gives you 13. And he's got 22 in his basement. You know, I don't know how that's going to change anything.
This all sounds silly because there's too many variables. There's too many people whose sanity you can't judge. But I like the idea of just trying. Even if it's not all that effective, I want at least window dressing to it, and we can't even accomplish that.
Pete Buttigieg said something. He said, you know, because he said, well, the people who say this isn't going to fix it or this wouldn't have stopped that one.
Right.
He said, so what? After 9/11, you know, we changed the law. We fundamentally changed what we did. We didn't say, well, this isn't going to stop everyone, so we're not going to do anything.
Yeah, that's a good
point. We did what we could.
Well, particularly this House bill, so I'm just looking at it. The bill establishes new background check requirements for firearm transfers between private parties. Specifically, it prohibits a firearm transfer between private parties unless a licensed gun dealer, a manufacturer, or importer first takes possession of the firearm to conduct the background check. So that's where the background check comes in. And I don't know if that's going to fix the problem, but what the hell? Let's give it a try.
If somebody is a problem, I just feel like all of these shooters, there's been some kind of a sign. I don't want to blame the family for what happened. Hey, you knew this was going to happen. But somebody needs to, the school should have called law enforcement. Some kind of common sense phone call to law enforcement or something that should have been enough. I don't even know if we need all these new laws. And I don't know that gun transfers, you know, private gun transfers are really
right.
The answer
either.
I'm not sort of.
I don't see why that's so hard to pass. I mean, like, I think everybody who wants a gun is still going to have a gun.
I do too.
If they were to call and say, hey, we got this guy and we're worried about him, what comes next?
Do they go in and search the house for weapons? I'm not sure. But I think if somebody has a rape list and a kill list, I think that something needs to be done. There's an involuntary, you know, commitment, something like that. That it's not normal to have these things in hand and to be thinking about
this. He was taken out of his high school, right? And then after a time was allowed to return.
Right. And then people were, and somebody pointed out some kids skipped school because they were so afraid of him.
No kidding. Elgin and Elburn are in. Naperville is a no. St. Charles is a maybe. Illinois towns are considering if they will allow the sale of marijuana in their municipalities. I like the idea of autonomy. What would you do if you were the king of your town? Justin, you live in Chicago, right? So you're the king of Chicago.
Finally.
Will you allow recreational retail points?
Yeah, I do. I would. Especially, you know, when you talk about some of these towns, and I know that Naperville determined it because they have a family-friendly brand. That was what their argument from the board, the saying, hey, we have a brand, we're trying to stick to it, we don't want to bring this in. The only problem I have with it is just that at a certain point, you have six or seven people at the, you know, at the board level making the decision for a community that's probably thousands and thousands.
In Naperville, it was five to four.
Yeah, five
it was
to four, close. But that's how close it is. And I feel like in any other, I can't think of any other business that you would regulate beyond maybe guns that you would say you don't want in your town. I don't understand it. It's legal now, and I feel like if I were running a town, I would want to bring that kind of business and that kind of revenue to and that kind of convenience to my town.
So Justin Kaufmanville has
yay,
Eric.
I would agree with that as well. And be clear, the Illinois Policy Institute does not have to take a position on this. But if I'm now king of my town,
Kaufmanville.
I grew up downstate.
Where?
Belleville.
Belleville?
I don't know if they've made a decision on it yet, but I just tend to agree with what was just said, that you're probably going to want the revenue. I think a bigger point to all of this is, you know, if it's going to be allowed as point of sale in Naperville or not in Naperville, people who from Naperville who want to acquire it are still going to go acquire it. It's my hope that the revenue is put towards something that we actually need to address in this state, like, say, maybe the pension problem. Mm-hmm. I'm more interested on that side of things than where it is and is not sold.
Where are you?
I agree with you. We need the money. You know, set it up on every
this
block.
This is so gross, though, isn't it? Okay, I know.
We will Chicago will change it. We're the not family-friendly brand. No. In Chicago, I live in Chicago,
we
too.
We hate families here.
I know, but
I do think that these towns, they should have the autonomy.
What if we didn't need the money? What if we were Minnesota and we had a surplus? That's the state of Minnesota. But suppose Chicago and Illinois didn't have the budgetary problems they do. Would your opinions about this change because the revenue stream wouldn't be so important?
I think the revenue is the weakest argument in favor of changing the marijuana laws as they existed. If you were to go back in time and tell people, describe the effects of people smoking marijuana, and then describe the effects of people drinking alcohol, and say, in the future, one of these two is illegal and the other is not, would anybody guess that it would be marijuana that's illegal? I don't think so.
Aren't you nervous? I don't think we really know what the ultimate repercussions are going to be of recreational marijuana.
But I think we know the repercussions of the prohibition regime that has existed, that has the total drug prohibition regime that has existed for years, which is terrible.
So I don't understand what you mean. We're not going to know the repercussions.
Not that long.
Go to California.
I don't know.
When I'm in California and it's not what I think about, it's not like I'm like, oh, man, the day of marijuana is legal here. It doesn't matter. At a certain point, it's just another storefront, and you're into it or you're not into it. And it doesn't. There's not a prevailing culture. It's not like it's going to turn into idiocracy here.
I was visiting my daughter, and I was like day three into it. I'm like, oh, damn, I completely forgot.
It's just another business in town. I don't think, and frankly, I think there's a little stereotype too. This idea that it's some sort of I got to get buzzed in, and it's a scourge to your community. These places are sweet. When you go to them, right. There are, especially the higher end ones, and that's what's unfortunately going to happen. The one in Naperville, if they let it in Naperville, will be all white counters, real nice, get what you want.
Where the buds are curated.
Yeah, the buds are curated. The bud tender comes over, can I get something for you? It'll be better than than half of the businesses there.
My son,
I don't get it.
Noah went to one in Washington, and he talked about, you know, the hints of cherry and the wood burning and all
right.
Other stuff.
Okay.
You know,
it's like, ban the liquor stores.
Wine culture.
I think the issue that's going to come up. But beyond just selling, and I think the issue that's going to come up is in the workplace. I really do. I think that you're going to see, I have family in Colorado and Washington, and I've heard stories from them. One, like, moved from a regular job to a management gig, and, you know, had somebody sort of blazing up in their car at noon and then coming back in, and there really weren't.
Or if you're doing chewables or edibles, and
right.
That's less detected.
Right.
Traffic enforcement is another
issue
as well. I haven't been king yet. I want to be king.
In Bertrandville.
I want my town to be Lyle. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to line the border of Naperville with pot shops. That's what I'm going to do.
Be the fireworks of Indiana,
exactly.
In other words.
You bet.
Okay, but I just for the record, so when they play back this in the time capsule, at least one voice will have said, I'm not sure that we really have a handle on developing brains about adolescents who aren't legal, but they're close enough to it that they're going to have access to it. And the only reason that we all have this flip attitude about it is because at the end of the day, the states and the municipalities need money. It's gross to me, the fact that
What's missing in that argument is to act as if this is brand new. People have been smoking weed. Kids have been smoking weed.
It's brand new for the state to start cashing in on it. The state wasn't cashing in before. We're endorsing it as a state.
I agree with you that some of the rationale that we use for it is entirely gross. However, I think there's an important point to be made and something to remember, that just because something is legal doesn't mean that we believe it to be moral or honorable. And there's a full cultural element to all of that that's like, would I encourage my children to smoke marijuana? No, I would not. Does that mean that I want the state empowered to arrest people and put them in jail if they choose to do those kinds of things? I don't want that either.
He's the king of my town, too.
Chief of police of his town, Jack.
You can have Justin Town.
Is there anything else that you wanted to bring
one
up?
One more thing. Last night, the Chicago Bears played in a preseason game against Carolina Panthers.
I was going to bring this up.
The only thing, it's preseason, who cares? I can't tell you the amount of, and I think it's real, and I think it's weird, the amount of anxiety that I had as a fan to watch the kickers line up and kick a field goal. And I thought it was a joke over the summer. Oh, they're going to do it. But the anxiety of actually as they line up and that shot on TV where here it is, he's about to hit it, and he missed it. I don't know this is a good thing. This circus that has happened around the Chicago Bears in the offseason, I don't think it's healthy for fans, for the players, for the management. This is bad. I've never seen this in the NFL. I've never seen...
Organizationally, you don't think the Bears handled it well?
I don't think they handled it well. I just feel as a Bears fan, there's anxiety when it's something that... If he misses it, he misses it.
Friend,
I don't understand.
If you can hang out until January 1st, I can help with the anxiety.
Why? What's January 1st? Oh,
I'm moving to Bertrand Town.
God, am I not even listening to this podcast?
I've heard this called bullying. This has been referred to as bullying. Yeah. This bullying culture in the Bears because they're doing this.
I think there's something to be said. Last night, there was a lot of sarcastic booing.
Look at that kind of bullying culture, sadly, has existed in sports for a long time. Yeah. Look at what Red Sox fans did to Bill Buckner for something that arguably he wouldn't have made Bartman, it to the bag, even if he fielded that ball cleanly in the 86 World Series.
You know the thing.
But I just want to add that while I appreciate the anxiety point, I'll make the confession. I am a New York Giants fan, and our offseason has been absolutely atrocious, so I'm out of sympathy.
I have this feeling last year, and I'm going to have it again this year. I have some apprehension about endorsing a sport that I think is really hard on those individuals.
Yeah.
And each year I get a little more like this. I get this thought just begins to take over a little bit more of my thought process. And I don't know if it's going to happen anytime soon. Maybe never in my lifetime, but the NFL and big time college football are damaging those young men's bodies, and it's really fun to watch, and we can't seem to kick it.
There was a Freakonomics piece several years ago comparing American football to similar sports like rugby and Australian rules football, where they don't have the same amount of padding, they don't have the helmets. It's one of those weird unintended consequences things, right? So as helmets have gotten quote-unquote more safe, players believe they can throw themselves around with more reckless abandon because the helmets are safer, but in reality, it's actually what is causing the problem. But to your point about what will happen with football in the future, there's a really fascinating book from a writer named Chuck Klosterman a few years ago called But What If We're Wrong, where he kind of theorizes that what most people think, the violence will kill the NFL, it may be the one thing that saves it, that people want an outlet for something that violent in a sporting world. And it's a diminished sport. It's not the number one sport in America anymore, but it may be the thing that keeps it going.
It's not the number one sport in America anymore. What is?
Oh, I say NBA arguably is right now, but you know, it NFL dominated for years, and it's certainly number two if it's not number one. As much as I'm a baseball and hockey guy first and foremost, but if it does diminish, it may be that the violence is the thing that saves it.
How about that? Interesting point, Eric. Thanks for joining us today. Lisa, thanks for coming in as well.
Thanks for having me.
We sure appreciate your voices on the Mincing Rascals. Steve Bertrand just left. He just walked out. But that's because he's getting ready for his WGN Radio Wintrust Business Hour. I see you, Mr. Kaufman.
Good to see you back, buddy.
Yeah, it's good to be here. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Elif Garris. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.